I'll tell our producer that he got a standing ovation. Yeah. So kind of interesting, right? It gets you thinking about this fine-tuning argument, which is one of the major arguments for intelligent design. So if you want to learn a little bit more about fine-tuning, I know this is just a tiny little taste, I'd encourage you to go to a website that's privilegedspecies.com. Privilegedspecies.com has three different films that you can watch for free online regarding fine-tuning of our species, our universe. And then also there's links to books like The Privileged Planet and other books on fine-tuning. Okay, so at this point in the program, it's my pleasure to introduce our first speaker, Michael Behe. He is professor of biological sciences at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. He's also a senior fellow of the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. He received his PhD in biochemistry from University of Pennsylvania in 1978, and he's continued ever since to research this delineation between intelligent design and natural selection. Over his career, he's written over 40 technical papers. I think that's outdated. It's probably more than that now. But anyways, many technical papers. And in a couple weeks now, he will have authored three books. Darwin's Black Box was his first. The Edge of Evolution next. And then coming out here in a week and a half is his new title, Darwin Devolves, The New Science About DNA That Challenges Evolutions. His books have been internationally reviewed hundreds of times, and in fact, his first title was named one of the 100 most important books of the 20th century by National Review and World Magazine. So that's a pretty big deal. So he's truly one of the founding fathers of the intelligent design community, and it's great to have him here today. He'll join me in welcoming.
Thanks very much, Daniel. It's great to be here. I feel that to really be noticed, though, I need one of those masks, you know, with the little nose on it and stuff. It's really cool. I feel at home now that I saw the snow outside. I don't know if you noticed. It's slowed down a little bit now. But okay, let's start her up. The title, as you can see, is Depth of Design, Edge of Evolution. And it indicates that I think, and I probably most people here think, that there is design in life, but there's accident too. And there are, you know, birth defects and stuff. So there's accidents even in biology. And so where is it reasonable to draw a line between the two? How far down, how deep into life does design go? And on the other hand, how much can randomness and evolution explain? I've been interested in this for a while. And in 1996, as Daniel pointed out, I wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box. And in it, my primary argument was that I didn't think Darwinian random mutation and natural selection could explain a number of things that have been discovered at the cellular and molecular level of life. As Daniel said, I'm a biochemist. Biochemistry studies the molecular level of life, and you see all sorts of things there. So I was professionally interested in this and came to the conclusion that, in fact, Darwinian processes had been greatly overrated. And one of the main problems was something I termed irreducible complexity. And irreducible complexity can be illustrated by this mousetrap. Now, I guess I should back up and say that in his book, The Origin of Species, Charles Darwin wrote, and Daniel had that quotation up, he said that if there existed some organ that could not be put together by numerous successive slight modifications, then my theory would break down. But he says, I can't find any such case. Well, what sort of case would challenge Darwin's theory? What kind of a thing couldn't be, or sure doesn't look like it could be, put together by numerous successive slight modifications. And an irreducibly complex system fits the bill. And in an irreducibly complex system, that means you have a system, a cell or an organ or a piece of machinery that has a number of different parts, but it needs all the parts to work. And if you take one away, it stops working. And an example from our everyday world is the mousetrap up here. It's got a number of parts, the platform, the spring, and a number of other parts too. And if you took one of them away, it would be not, it wouldn't work half as well as it used to, or a quarter as well as it used to. It would be broken. It wouldn't work at all. So, you know, how, if you wanted to evolve something like a mousetrap by something like a Darwinian process, you know, what would you do? How would you start? Would you start with, say, a wooden platform? Just the platform here, and hope to catch mice inefficiently. You know, maybe the mouse would trip as it ran over the wood, and then maybe you could say add the catch. What's called the catch here? Oh no, I'm sorry. This is this arm here of the spring. I'm getting rusty here. The holding bar, and maybe just add that to the platform, and then if the mouse tripped, it might impale itself on that holding bar, and that would be an improvement. Well, no, it's funny to think about, but it really doesn't work. So the thing is, with irreducibly complex systems, you don't really get the function of the system until it's pretty much all put together. Now, this is a problem for Darwin's theory of evolution by numerous successive slight modifications, because there's nothing for natural selection to select until it's there. So these things seem to be answers to Darwin's challenge. Well, it's interesting. Mousetraps are interesting, but is there anything in living systems like this? And especially since biology has progressed and we've seen that the basis of life is the cellular and molecular level, are there any such things at the foundation of life? And it turns out, yeah, there are tons of them. It's hard to study in a biochemistry textbook without seeing one such thing on every page. And my favorite example is this. It's called the bacterial flagellum, which Daniel had told me he wouldn't talk about, but that's all right. This is cool enough that you could talk about it all day. And the bacterial flagellum is quite literally an outboard motor. I think you can see by looking at it that this is a machine. It's got a number of different parts. It's got the motor. It's got the drive shaft, clamps to hold it in the membrane. It's got the propeller. And just like the mousetrap, it's irreducibly complex. You know, if you take away the motor, if you take away the propeller or the drive shaft, you don't have a flagellum that spins half as fast as it used to, or a quarter as fast. It's broken. You don't have a rotary motor. You don't have a flagellum. So again, something like this is a big challenge to Darwin's theory, and that was essentially the point I argued in that book. But there's a flip side to irreducibly complex systems, and that is the following, that that's how we recognize design. Now, Daniel was talking about specified complexity and all sorts of letters and stuff. I'm not smart enough to follow that as much. And it turns out that, let's take a look at the next slide. Okay, this is a Far Side cartoon. And there's a troop of jungle explorers here down here. And the first guy has been strung up and skewered. And this fellow turns to that guy and says, "That's why I never walk in front." Words to live by. Let me assure you. Now, everybody here looks at this cartoon, and you immediately realize that that trap was designed. That wasn't an accident. As a matter of fact, the humor of the cartoon depends upon you recognizing the design. Wouldn't be all that funny if you just fell over a cliff or something. But how do you know that? How do you know that this was designed? You know, is it a religious conclusion? Probably not. Unless your religion, you know, has this mask on, you know, you have to have this mask on. No, it's not a religious conclusion. It's just an observation we make every day. And that is that we recognize design, we recognize a mind behind something when we see a purposeful arrangement of parts. That is when we see some separate things brought together in order to do something that the individual parts can't do. So we see the vines and we see the bamboo shoots and so on, and we see, oh, those have been arranged. They've been put there by an intelligence. Now, if we go back one slide, that's exactly what we see with irreducibly complex systems, too. We see that they have been arranged for a purpose. And that's not some fuzzy, you know, religious, you know, feel-good type of conclusion. We conclude this every day. It's part of our mental abilities. We can recognize when some other intelligence has been doing stuff. So the thing is that irreducible complexity is a two-edged sword. It's not only a big problem for Darwin's theory because you can't put an irreducibly complex system together step by small Darwinian step, but it's also a strong pointer to design. This is how we conclude that a mind has been at work, how something has been intelligently arranged. Okay, well, I expected when the book came out that everybody would say, oh yeah, you're right, I didn't think of that. That almost happened, but not quite. But I stayed interested in this topic. And again, if you're like me and you think that there are many structures in life really required purposeful design, but not everything required design, you know, maybe the exact shape of your nose didn't require explicit design and so on, well, then where is the edge, the border, the rough line between what did require design and what might be produced by random changes plus evolution or plus natural selection? And in that book, The Edge of Evolution, I focused on malaria. Now, malaria is a killer disease caused by a single cell, the malarial parasite. Its name is Plasmodium falciparum, and it infects mosquitoes, and then when mosquitoes bite people, it goes into people. So it's not the poor mosquitoes. They don't like it one bit either. It's they're hijacked as much as we are. And it still kills, you know, 500,000 people a year, mostly, you know, children. Well, a while back, a drug was invented to treat malaria, and it was a wonder drug called chloroquine. And people would take chloroquine who were, you know, on death's door, and they would recover. And it was great. It saved millions and millions of lives. But after about a decade or so of being used, doctors in the field would notice that they'd give chloroquine to somebody, and they wouldn't recover as quickly as they used to. They'd need a second dose, and after a second dose, they'd be okay. And then they noticed that a couple more people would have this resistance to chloroquine. And pretty soon, almost everybody had resistance to chloroquine. And it turned out that the Plasmodium falciparum, the malarial parasite, had evolved resistance to the chloroquine. And it's interesting because there's an enormous amount of Plasmodium falciparum malaria in the world. As I said, in each the parasite is a single cell, and when it gets into a person, it starts to reproduce, and it pretty much eats people's blood. That's the problem. But when you're sick with malaria, a person can have up to a trillion malaria cells in his body. And since there's, you know, hundreds of millions of people who get malaria each year, there can be 10 to the 20th malarial cells produced each year, which is, you know, 100 million trillion. So a lot. There's a lot of cells. Let's use that technical term. But chloroquine is different because other anti-malarial drugs don't have nearly the resistance that chloroquine has. For example, there's a drug called atovaquone. And atovaquone was discovered in laboratories where people would have little cultures of malaria cells in a flask, and they would test compounds, put some of in the flask and see if it killed the malarial cells. And the atovaquone would reliably kill the malarial cells. But it turns out there were only about a million malarial cells in those flasks. And the atovaquone worked great. But when it was given to patients in the field, about one out of every other or every third patient would spontaneously develop resistance. That is, the atovaquone would be given, the malaria would kind of ease back, but then come back with a vengeance. And it turns out that it takes about a trillion malarial cells for one to have the lucky mutation that confers resistance. And in that flask of a million cells, there just wasn't enough chances. But in a person, it has so many more of these that just by luck, it develops resistance. So about every third patient, because people carry so many malarial cells, about every third patient develops spontaneous resistance. It doesn't have to have a resistant strain transferred by a mosquito. This is new resistance to the drug. But for chloroquine, it's about every billionth patient, every billionth patient. So why is chloroquine so much tougher to develop resistance to than something like atovaquone? Well, the idea of the book, Edge of Evolution, is that it's the same principle as winning the lottery, Powerball. Well, suppose you were in a lottery where you had to guess the right number from 1 to 100. Your chances of winning are what? 1 in 100. Okay, all right. We have some math majors in the audience. Okay. Well, suppose you had to match two numbers between 1 and 100. So are the chances 1 in 101 or 1 in 102? No, of course not. Because each one is 1 in 100, so it's 1 in 100 times 1 in 100, or 1 in 10,000. It goes up exponentially with the number of ones you have to match. Well, it turns out that for a tovaquone, there's just one change that has to be made to give the malaria resistance to it. And the genome, the size of the DNA in malaria, is about every 1 in 100 million or so. So allowing for other factors, that's about right. You know, you change one thing and it's got resistance. But for chloroquine, you have to change two things. And so that's 1 in 100 million times 1 in 100 million. And so you for a tovaquone, every 3 people, for chloroquine, every billion people. That's roughly 100 million times 3. So the point is that if you just need 2 independent changes, Darwin's mechanism of random mutation and natural selection starts to go south pretty quick, simply because there's not enough chances to find those mutations. And I actually just kind of proposed that in the book because it was not yet known for sure that 2 mutations were needed, but it was a very, very simple hypothesis, and other people had wondered about that too in the literature. But then a little bit later, about 7 years after the book came out, some scientists did some terrific and heavy work and showed that, yes, you have to change 2 places in a gene before malaria develops resistance to chloroquine. So I pointed out that this number of malarial cells, 10 to the 20th, 100 times a million times a trillion, was needed for just 2 crummy little changes, the 2 smallest kinds of changes, coordinated changes that's possible, you know, for to have. And yet, it took 100 million trillion organisms to get these 2 things. And malaria can reproduce, because it's just a single cell, in such huge quantities that it eventually could find the solution or hit upon the solution. But if you're talking about larger organisms like bunny rabbits, people, giraffes, fish, anything, there aren't enough of them in the history of the world to hit upon just these 2 crummy little coordinated mutations. So in the book, I made the point that this was an observation. This is not a theory or a calculation or a speculation on the part of somebody who's skeptical about Darwin's theory. This was an observation from data in the field that no unintelligent process could help the malaria develop anything but the tiniest little changes in pre-existing machinery to help against this deadly threat of chloroquine. Not only Darwinism, but other variations that some folks have proposed on Darwin's theory these days, such as self-organization, self-engineering, and stuff. Not only that, no undiscovered process was of any use either. You have to remember that this was just out in nature. Nobody was restricting what the organisms could do. If there was a way it could produce some new, you know, machine, like, say, the flagellum, but a pump for pumping out chloroquine or destroying it or something like that, go ahead, do it. You know, let's see what you got. But only 2 simple coordinated mutations were of any help. So I took this piece of information and ran with it. I said, well, okay, if you look at anything in the cell, like two proteins, which are parts of the machinery of the cell, they have to stick to each other. And in order to stick to each other, the parts, like the parts of a mousetrap, are hammered into place and placed by humans, and there's little staples to keep them in place. But proteins have to recognize each other by having their shapes, the geometric and chemical interactions have to be complementary. So you have to have a positive charge on one versus a negative charge next to a negative charge on the other, and an oily patch on one near an oily patch on another, and things like that. And they have to, you know, have bumps where the others have grooves and vice versa. But in order to get such what's called a binding site on one protein for another, that's a job that would require multiple changes in amino acids, in residues. You'd need to say six-ish or so changes in residues just for two proteins to stick together. And to give you an idea, in case you've forgotten, there's probably 20,000 different proteins in the cell, which all of which bind to each other. And many protein machines that have dozens of protein parts. So forget about the function, just getting these guys together to stick specifically is something that's well beyond the edge of evolution, to coin a phrase. Well, most people, including probably most people here, aren't as interested as I am in protein-protein binding sites. It's always been a mystery to me, but that seems to be the case. They're a lot more interested in things like sea urchins, right? Well, animals and stuff in general, and things you can see and so on. Well, I argued back in the day, 12 years ago now, that in fact, new science has shown that the development of the shapes and organs and so on of animals is enormously complicated. On the slide there is a diagram of all of the proteins that are involved in a developmental pathway of one kind of tissue in the sea urchin. Looks like an electrical diagram. And in fact, in ways it is, or it's much more like a computer program in which this goes and that. And oftentimes, if you take out one of these things, you know, you don't get a sea urchin. You get something dead or, malformed. So I made an argument, which I won't go into here, that in order to, these things are needed for new cell types, and different vertebrate classes need new cell types, take my word for it, so that the depth of design at that time, I thought, was at the level of vertebrate class. And class is like birds versus fish versus mammals and so on. So I wrote that design extends all the way from the fine-tuning of the laws of the universe down through the position of the world in a habitable zone, down to the amazing properties of water and chemicals and so on, down to vertebrate class. In other words, all those things had to be purposely arranged or you wouldn't get anything like birds or fish or mammals. And I continued that it may descend further, the design, but that's all the further that our evidence could take us at the time, so that somewhere between vertebrate class and species was that edge of evolution. But science marches on. And it turns out that a whole lot of new abilities have come around just in the past dozen years or so. Most spectacularly in the ability of science to decode, to read the DNA of different species. Daniel said that a human genome has been decoded, but now the dog genome has been decoded, and the cat genome, and the genome of rice, and the genome of bacteria, and grizzly bears, and polar bears, and elephants, and extinct, you know, mastodons, and many, many others. And that's a big deal because mutations are changes at the molecular level. They're changes in genes. And before, about 10 years ago, it was real hard to track down exactly what the mutation was at the molecular level that caused some beneficial change. But now, with the advance of science, that's a lot easier to track down. And that's pretty much what the new book is about. And it goes on sale in 10 days and makes a wonderful, you know, 4th of July gift, Memorial Day gift. But, oh, that's it's just, you thought you might be interested. And the new book makes three key concepts in it. The first rule of adaptive evolution, the principle of comparative difficulty, and something I call the family line. And we will go through each of these in turn. Let's start with the principle, first rule of adaptive evolution. And it used to be the case that people would say that, well, you can't study evolution because what are you going to do? You're going to go out and see, how many mutations there are in an elephant, and and then follow it over generations and see when it changes into something really impressive. That takes a lot longer than an average grant from the federal government. So why bother? But this fellow, a man named Richard Lenski, who's a professor of microbiology at Michigan State University, started something 30 years ago with bacteria. He started in his lab to grow E. coli bacteria, which pretty much that's the standard bacterium to use in the lab. And what he did was he had a flask with some solution containing nutrients for the bacterium, and he put some bacteria in, and he let it grow overnight. And the bacteria would grow until it ate all of the available nutrients. And in that time, since bacteria have very rapid life cycles, it would go through about 6 or 7 generations just overnight. And he came in the next morning, and he got another flask of nutrients, and he took a bit of the first flask, and he put it in the second flask, and let that go overnight. And there was another 6 or 7 generations. They ate the food. And he came in the next morning, he did the same thing, and the same thing. And it's been going on for 30 years. So that now there have been 70,000 generations of bacteria in his lab, trillions of separate cells in the experiment. So now there is plenty of generations, plenty of numbers of organisms to follow what changes they could undergo. And he did this explicitly to see how evolution would work, what would change. And one thing he noticed back in the day, soon after he started, was that one particular kind of bacteria started to outgrow, outcompete its fellow bacteria, elbow them aside, and it would take over the flask. But back then, the technology to sequence DNA was unavailable. And so he just kind of described the mutations as, here's what it is, here's what we can see, but he didn't know what the mutation was. And it was only around the turn of the century, turn of the millennium, 2000, that they were able to track down that molecular change. And it turns out that it was a change in a gene region that contains genes for a couple of proteins that are involved in the metabolism of a sugar called ribose in the bug. And when they sequenced that region, they saw that it was gone. It had been destroyed by some internal rearrangement in the bacterium. And so the mice, or not mice, the E. coli missing that actually grew better than ones that still had it. And he noticed then that the expression of ribose and maltose enzymes decreased, but that was beneficial, and the deletion of those things, the tossing away of them, was helpful. So let's emphasize this. A mutation which was beneficial turned out to be one that degraded the DNA of the species, that threw away something. It was better for it to be without that. As time passed and technology improved and their lab kept plugging along, they found dozens of other genes that helped bacterium grow faster. And you'll have to take my word for this, but all of the mutations degraded genes, either broke them outright or made them less effective. So after 30 years, after 70,000 generations, after trillions of independent organisms, these cells, he's discovered that, yes, Darwin's mechanism works. Random mutation and selection can help a bacterium survive and prosper, but it does it through the degradation of pre-existing genes. You might say to yourself, I don't get it. You know, how does that work? Well, here's an analogy that that might help. Suppose your life depended on your car getting a little bit better gas mileage. What's the quickest way that you could get it to get better gas mileage? Well, you could take the hood off and throw it away, and the doors off and throw those away. Take your spouse and, well, no, that's, wait. And lower the weight of the car. Well, hoods and doors are useful in many circumstances, but if the most important thing for your survival right now is better gas mileage, you're best off tossing all those other things. I got more analogies, but in the interest of time, we'll let it sit with that. So I wrote after the book came out, I guess. In 2010, I wrote a paper where I coined a phrase called the first rule of adaptive evolution. Break or blunt any functional coded element, that's a gene, break or blunt any gene whose loss would yield a net fitness increase. And that's evolution talk for more kids, in population increase. So that's the first rule. That's the thing that you would expect random mutation to do first, because it's easy to break a gene, a lot easier than making some specific or set of specific changes in some other genes. Just like, it's much more rapid to break a gene. So if any circumstance, the bacteria was experiencing some selective pressure, and it could either break this gene here or, build a fancy new piece of equipment, and it would take roughly a week to do this, and take 10 million years to do that. Well, guess which one's going to show up first? And so here's the reason that there are many. You can change a gene in almost any place, and it will break. And it's very hard to change a gene so that it would improve. Okay, I'm actually going to skip through these in the interest of time. Again, here's the bottom line. After now 70,000 generation, all of the identified beneficial mutant genes have been degraded or broken. And you have to remember that since these are beneficial mutations, natural selection will select them. They will increase in the population so that in a relatively very short time, the whole population will consist of ones with the broken gene. For example, in the illustration that Daniel had of the bunny rabbits, in the open field, they probably adapted by having the gene that helped produce their color broken. And if it can no longer work, they'd be lighter in color. But remember, that doesn't explain how the gene got there in the first place. And number two, when it's gone, it's gone. You know, there's no remotely as quick process to restore a broken gene. And so here's another take-home lesson. It's been known for a long time that of those mutations that affect an organism, about 99% are detrimental. Everybody knows that. You know, doctors certainly know that. If a patient has a mutant gene, they're almost always in trouble. But the standard story said that, well, yeah, but those poor blokes would just die off. And ones with the rare occasional beneficial mutation would prosper and take over the population. But now, because of the advance of science and our ability to track down what those mutations are by DNA sequencing, we can now know that of even the beneficial mutations, the great majority break genes. So that's what random mutation does. It's real good at that, at breaking genes, and sometimes that's helpful in certain environments. Another point to make is that this process is as relentless as the tide. That is, whenever mutation and selection can throw something out, and it has some positive effect, it'll do it right away, and start to spread in a population. Well, suppose somebody comes back and says, yeah, but what if a constructive mutation comes around that is on its way to making something new? That can happen, but you have to remember that that's pretty slow, and while it's going on, more broken genes are arising. And after it happens, more and more can arise. And if any of them help, or if any of them help fine-tune the constructive mutation, they will continue to spread. So it's kind of like shoveling sand against the tide. You might put your shovel in and get a scoop and throw it away, but this tide's coming in, and it's not going to last. And just to kind of ground this in science, in Richard Lenski's experiment about 10 years or so ago, they saw a mutant bacterium that had gained the ability to eat a chemical called citrate, you know, like citrus fruit. It's a common chemical in the cell. And they touted this in the press, and all good Darwinians, you know, wiped the sweat off their brow and said, oh, now at last we have our evidence of construction. Well, it turns out that if you look at the gene level, there was just the rearrangement of a few pieces of the gene. There wasn't anything new produced. But okay, let's say that say it was a significant constructive change anyway. An interesting thing to remember is that this strain suffered all of the mutations that I showed you previously. It lost the ability to make ribose and maltose. It lost a pyruvate kinase. It lost all sorts of things. So it lost a dozen genes. Maybe it's rearranging one gene, but it's lost a dozen already. And what's more, Lenski's student, this guy named Quant, showed that the bacteria continued to evolve, to fine-tune its ability to eat citrate. And it did so by breaking more genes. I won't read these out in the interest of time. It broke these genes and broke some more genes. And this was in the interest of fine-tuning that change that they touted. So again, the point is, this is relentless. There's no stopping it. It continually goes on, and since it's much faster than constructive changes, it will predominate in the short and long term. So in a summary, Darwin's mechanism, it turns out, is dominated by what I call poison pill mutations. That is, they are positively selected, beneficial, but they're loss of function mutations. And so the plain English summary of this is that Darwin's mechanism works by squandering genetic information for short-term gain. And I've got a bunch of examples to show you, which I will mention one or two. But one good one is puppy dogs. Everybody loves puppy dogs. They're often pointed to by evolutionists, too, as saying, look at all the variation you can get starting from a wolf ancestor. And, oh, isn't evolution wonderful? And it's interesting, but now we can sequence the genomes of dog breeds to see what is causing their changes in shape. And again, I won't go into it, but they're overwhelmingly broken genes or broken regulatory elements or broken other stuff. Polar bear, descended from the grizzly bear, a large proportion of the genes that differ between the two were predicted to be functionally damaging. Okay. So the polar bear descended from the brown bear mostly by devolution rather than evolution. Hence the name of the book, Darwin Devolves. It is working by devolution. And I think I'll show you one more slide and then call it a day. Here's a good image of Darwinian processes at work. I got this picture on the internet. I can't find it now. I think the bad guys took it away. But this is some South American country, and the police or the army learned that there was a drug operation going on up a road. And so they were sent out to shut it down. But the drug guys heard about this. And there was only one road leading to there, so they blew up the bridge that the army would use to come and put them out of operation. Now, from the point of view of the drug operation, this is a beneficial mutation. They are surviving because of breaking the bridge. But number one, this does not tell you how bridges are built in the first place. completely unrelated. And this is a loss rather than a gain, even if it does give you a short-term advantage. Okay, I have enough for Paul's time slot too, but I think I'll stop for now. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Behe. So we're going to take a few minutes for Q&A, maybe about 5 or 6 minutes. So if you have a question, please step up to either this mic or the mic on the other side here so that we can all hear your question and it can be recorded properly. So come on up.
So as a real layman here, it's moving from design to chaos in Darwin theory. Am I correct in that?
You could put it that way, but these are still beneficial. So you could look at it as you start out with a design that has chock full with information for all sorts of situations, and some of the species go over here and, you know, lose genes that are not needed or the loss of which is beneficial for this. And some of the original ones could go over there and lose different genes because they're in a different environment, so that the original design provided for the ability to diversify into different species. But that, of course, doesn't explain where the original design came from. And the interesting thing is that once they lose the genes, they kind of get stuck where they are. So they can't go much further. You're not going to likely take a polar bear somewhere else and it's going to regain its color and things like that. It's pretty much stuck where it is. So this actually might go a long way towards explaining extinction of species. As an organism adapts more and more to an environment, it might lose more and more genetic information, become more brittle, and then some change comes along for which it can no longer cope, and it goes extinct.
Yes. As far as the microbes are concerned, are there any mutations that, rather than destroying the gene, just kind of shut it down, so that subsequent subcultures, if they were returned to an environment where, say, I think ribose was the sugar you mentioned,
yes,
suddenly ribose was reintroduced, then the gene would turn back on, and they'd be able to utilize it again. Were any of them like reversible mutations?
Yes. The short answer is yes, but the longer answer is no. And as a matter of fact, Lenski's experiment came across something like that. A number of the strains, he had 12 separate containers of E. coli just for replicability's sake, and a number of them developed into what are called mutators. That is, a gene involved in correcting errors that the cell makes copying its DNA was broken. And so they accumulated mutations a lot faster than normal. But he followed one culture and it regained at least some of the ability. It mutated only half as fast as the pure mutator strains. Now, the mutator strains lost one nucleotide in the gene for the error-correcting protein. So all it really had to do to gain it back was to add back that nucleotide, just one. But it turns out the ones that gained better error-correcting abilities did so by breaking a separate gene, because it's statistically more frequent to break other genes, and if it can correct the error by breaking a different gene, that'll go faster than reversing the error that degraded the first gene. So that's what random mutation does. Whatever comes along fastest, anything will be selected, and it's statistically most likely to have broken genes arise than constructive changes. Yes, sir.
On the slide from your book, The Edge of Evolution, where you talked about at the class level, talking about some sort of barrier, is that in that slide, were you saying that somewhere changes between below class are, and sometimes can be explained by evolutionary theory, Darwinism?
Yeah, that's what I said at the time in year 2007, that we knew, I argued, that design had to extend at least to class, which is fish versus birds versus mammals and so on. But we didn't know if it extended deeper or if random processes could go higher. Turns out a part of the talk that I didn't have time to get to is the one I call the family line, where I say now design extends at least to the level of family, couple levels of biological classification lower. And you know, class is birds versus fish and so on, but family is cats versus dogs. So let me emphasize that I think now the science says that design has to extend at least to the level of cats versus dogs. And in the absence of design, you wouldn't get separate things of those kinds. But I also say that random changes can make new species and maybe even new genera, but not new families. Yes, sir.
Okay, in your discussion about the bacteria and the beneficial mutations, which were breaking of genes, something which you didn't develop, which I think is there, is that they're beneficial in the context of the solution that they were growing in. Mm-hmm. So would you comment on that? So if you break a ribose-producing gene or digesting gene, but you're living in a solution of sucrose, that's not harmful. But mm-hmm. in the wild, you don't survive. So you let these beneficial, it seems to me, mm-hmm. if you release these beneficial mutations into the wild, they don't do well.
Would you comment on
the context and the solution and how that interacts? Is it's not just purely beneficial. It doesn't seem to me.
Well, if you ask a Darwinian, and I think rightly, that random mutation and selection only see what's going on right now. They're not worried about what's going to happen later. If you don't get better gas mileage in your car right now, you lose the race or you're executed or whatever bad thing that you think would happen. So natural selection and random mutation are utterly blind. And if some organism finds itself in any situation, not just in the lab, but in the wild, where it would be beneficial to toss something, it will toss it. And as I said in response to an earlier question, that might explain why species go extinct, that they toss this to cope with this situation, then they toss that to cope with the other situation. Now they're stuck. They don't have much they can spare anymore, and a new situation comes along, and they just pass away. So yeah, they lost the ability to produce or metabolize ribose, and that probably would be beneficial under other circumstances. But it's gone for that population. Yes, sir.
I kind of have two questions, but they're kind of very close related. When I talk to people at evolution, one of the most closely cited sources of proof of this is the Lenski experiment, and specifically the ability to process citrate. And I was wondering, did the bacteria involved already have that ability? And I'm going to, for the second question, a little bit of conspiracy theory here. I know we have gene editing techniques. Do you think it's kind of possible that they might have edited the genes intentionally and put it into the experiment to have that ability?
No, I don't think so. You know, it's human beings are capable of lots of stuff, but there's no this is just what happened in Lenski's lab. They certainly are Darwinists and they cheer for what they think supports their theory, but they're honest guys. But you know, the first part of the question is great, you know, could it do this in the first place? And the answer is pretty much yes. It turns out it citrate is already produced and used by the original cells. It's an important chemical in the metabolism of them. But what they have a gene control region that shuts down the production of a protein that's in the wall, in the membrane of the cell, that will pull in citrate from the outside. So it can't, in the presence of oxygen, it can't pull this thing in, but in the absence of oxygen, it can. But in the Lenski experiment, oxygen was always present. So what happened is that the mutant lost the ability to express this protein that would be limited, and so it could import the citrate into the cell in the presence of oxygen. What happened is that the gene for the protein that is repressed in the presence of oxygen, there's other genes, you know, they're cheek by jowl, another gene next to it, which can be expressed in the presence of oxygen, they got tangled up in one cell that was replicating. And the control element of the second gene got placed next to the citrate transporter gene, and so now it could be turned on in the presence of oxygen. That's the only change in the citrate eater. So all of that stuff was pre-existing information in the genome, but it got rearranged a little bit. And that's interesting. But I would call that kind of a horizontal change. It didn't produce anything new. It just rearranged stuff. And again, the point of the devolution argument is that beforehand, this same strain lost maybe a dozen genes that we looked about. And after the rearrangement, in order to cope with this rearrangement, in order to fine-tune it, it lost some more genes. So I'm not saying that beneficial or constructive changes can never happen. It's just that they happen a whole lot less than ones that throw stuff away. And so they're going to get swamped over time. Yes, sir?
If I'm understanding what you're saying correctly, it doesn't sound like it's a very wise idea for us to be genetically modifying our seeds and crops. Can you address that?
Well, yeah, that's probably true. it's scary because, there's the old unintended consequences. You know, everybody involved in the genetic modification probably has the best of motives. They want to increase crop yield, feed people who are hungry, provide nutrients to people who are missing them and suffer from blindness and all sorts of stuff. But again, things can go wrong. And if a genetically modified organism, turns out to have some ability that nobody thought about before, you can be playing with fire. So there's, even the best of motives sometimes lead to situations which can be get out of control. And I have mixed feelings about all that stuff. Daniel, should we?
I think if we can make quick questions, we can get through the last three here.
What you really mean is quick answers. Yes, sir.
So, in the Lenski experiment, it was bacteria, which reproduced by cell division, and they were controlled in test tubes, so it was very easy to have a trait take over the population, right? Yes. Mm-hmm. It seems a bit more difficult in sexual reproduction, where these mutations have two things have to find each other, mm-hmm. right, and reproduce in larger populations, a little harder, less contained. Can you speak to that at all?
Do you mean that an unbroken gene remains in the population?
An individual with a mutation can take over the population.
Oh, okay.
Or his attributes, or that, yeah.
Okay, well, an individual with one mutation can help because If the mutation is partially dominant, that is, both the broken and the unbroken genes contribute, then the change with the single mutation could give it some benefit, which might be eventually increased by having a organism with both of its copies of a chromosome have the mutated gene. But if you get a partial benefit, that's a benefit too. And so that, just by natural selection, could take over. You know, the organism that has the partial benefit will have a few more kids than the ones that don't. In the next generation, those kids will have a few more than everybody else, and eventually the whole population will have it. So even mutation of just one of two copies from mom and dad could benefit, and there's lots of examples of such things. Yes, sir.
You probably already answered this, but if I wanted to return a poodle to a wolf, or a white rabbit to a brown, or a polar bear to a brown bear, could we do that through intelligent breeding?
Intelligent breeding?
Yeah.
I don't know anybody who's tried, but I will go on and out on a limb and say no, you won't be able to, because it's lost a lot of stuff. What you might do, though, is by natural selection, what you do is take the poodle and put it out in the wild, and the one that, you know, survives best. Yes, ma'am.
All right, so I guess I need a little practical help, and I'm probably very guilty of using the straw man argument, but I guess what other things can we use that are, quote, irreducibly complex to be able to say to my atheist brother, you know, mm-hmm. I don't know, besides, you know, because I think of human life and anything living as complex, and I would think very close to irreducibly complex, but I guess I'm struggling with how not to make just a simple argument.
Okay, perhaps the simplest one is to look at the simplest example of cooperation in, say, a protein that is, you know, the basis of all this machinery. There's something called a disulfide bond, perhaps you've heard of, you know, some people do. All right, there's this amino acid called cysteine, you might have heard of, and it's got a sulfur on it, and it can go with another cysteine and form a chemical bond between the two. When it does, that can stabilize a protein, and a lot of proteins have these chemical bonds between cysteines, and we don't have to go into it, but that can help sometimes. And you can say to your brother, you know, well, suppose there was a protein that didn't have a disulfide bond, and it would be beneficial for it to develop one. How long do you think it would take? Okay. Well, to get the first one, you might say, well, might take about 10 billion organisms. You know, with a mutation rate is about 1 in a billion. We'll say that could produce the first one. Well, how about that second one? Well, that would be another 1 in a billion or so. So that's 1 in 10 to the 18th. Which is, you know, pretty much all the mammals that have ever existed in the history of life. So, I'd say, keep it simple. So the simplest, Darwinism is great when you need only one change. If you need two at the same time to produce some selectable effect, that's when it starts to wheeze and cough. If you need more than that, then it's really bad.
The straw man's argument is kind of, you know, getting to those, being able to explain, you know, deeper. But I mean, we can look and say, hey, look at this life and how complex it really is. And then you can get down to the little, you know, proteins.
Yeah, exactly.
But you kind of have to start somewhere with people that may be less, you know, chemistry and less
oriented.
You know,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah. You do have, you know, Darwinism thrives in ignorance. If you don't know what's going on, somebody can come along in a lab coat and say, oh, that eye is easy to evolve. You just start with a light-sensitive spot, and then you just start to curl it up like this. They could explain, you know, Dr. Jekyll turning into Mr. Hyde as easily as that, but that's fiction, and so is the scenario for the eye. But you gotta know something. So if a person, you know, I've got my own relatives who, you know, have issues too, and if somebody's not willing to look into it and spend a little bit of time, well, then you have to do something else. Then you have to pray for them or, you know, give them gifts or something. Okay, you betcha.
Okay, we're going to watch one more brief video along the lines of the last one that we watched. I had some more comments, but I figured it'd be more helpful to extend the Q&A a little bit. So we're just going to jump right in, watch this video. It's on another argument. So we watched the argument of fine-tuning in the last video. This argument is one about the information of life in the DNA. So it ties in with what Dr. Behe talked about and also what we'll hear in our final session. So.
We've shown that DNA is actually the software of life. It's totally interchangeable between the digital world and the biological world.
The DNA code itself is so digital, is so almost exactly like a computer tape.
Totally interchangeable.